The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The city of Seattle, Washington, is moving forward in support of King County's plans to set up supervised consumption facilities in that area. On November 20th, the Seattle City Council adopted its annual budget, which included funding for these facilities, which for PR reasons they're referring to as Community Health Engagement Locations, or CHELs. The difference is semantic, intended to reassure people in the public that the purpose of these locations is to help bring healthcare services to populations that are not currently well served, and to bring people who use drugs closer to the healthcare system. I personally don't care what you call them. I know from the research that whether you call them sanitary injection facilities, supervised consumption sites, or drug consumption rooms, these are interventions that work to keep people healthy and alive. I also know that you can find a lot of that research on the web at drugwarfacts.org in the chapters on supervised consumption facilities and on syringe exchange. Supervised consumption facilities are in operation in cities around the world. They have saved countless lives that would otherwise have been lost to overdose, and they've prevented the spread of blood-borne diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. The InSight facility in Vancouver was the first supervised consumption facility in North America. I visited InSight several years ago, and I was quite impressed. Now there are more such facilities opening across Canada. We've been much slower to adopt harm reduction interventions in the United States, which means that here in the U.S., we have allowed many of our friends and family members to die needlessly. So, we'll start today's show with the Seattle City Council's meeting on November 20th. Some good news. There were several members of the public there at that meeting who spoke to the council about the need for a supervised consumption facility. Let's hear from some of those folks first.
Hi, council members. I'm Tarina James, and I'm here to thank you for funding the safe consumption sites here in the city of Seattle. I'm very thankful for that. But I also want to say that I want you all to know that all the people that are out here and they're solicited to living in these circumstances and have these addictions are hearing you. So please don't stop. Keep letting them know that you're working hard for them as we are saying it and we are doing it. I was a heroin addict, homeless in the streets of Seattle. And with the LEAD program, Public Defenders Association, vocal, familiar faces, I've been able to make it out and start a new life and do a lot of advocacy work. But not everybody has got there, and I would like to see a lot more people get out, get housing, and get their lives together. Thank you.
My name is Marlis McConnell, and I'm a mother here in support of Safe Consumption Spaces. This is my son, Andrew. Andrew lost his life to an accidental overdose January 6, 2015. He was just 27. Andrew wanted very much to find recovery, and he had hopes and dreams for his future, like all of us do. Andrew's last attempt at treatment was about 6 months before he died. And today I want to share something with you that he told me before entering that facility. I'm going to tell Courtney's parents, his girlfriend at the time, that I'm seeking treatment for a pill addiction. I'm worried they won't allow her to see me anymore if they know it's heroin. Heroin is so trashy. They supported him regardless, but my point is the community at large did not. He felt trashy. He felt stigmatized, and he felt ashamed. And I feel convinced that this played a part in his death. We cannot lead people to recovery that are no longer with us. We have to do a better job of providing services for those that need help with substance use disorder. We need to make sure they know they aren't trash. For those in our region who are still with us, struggling and suffering with substance use disorder, safe consumption spaces can help do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
We just heard Seattle residents Tarina James and Marlis McConnell. They were speaking in support of supervised consumption sites at a Seattle City Council meeting on November 20th. Now, let's hear from a Seattle City Council member shortly before the city budget was adopted unanimously. This is Seattle City Council member Rob Johnson.
And this is the part for speeches, I take it. So I'm just going to take a minute and say thanks, Councilmember Herbold, to you for working so collaboratively with me throughout this process. I'm really proud of a lot of the work that we did in this budget, the work on expansion of the law enforcement assisted diversion program, which I'm sure Councilmember Juarez will talk about in a minute, as well as some of the work that she and I did on access to those living inside food deserts, which is common in both of our districts. I'm also really proud of some of the transportation work that we did this year on pedestrianizing a two-block section of our city, connecting the University of Washington to the future light rail campus. Funding for small but important things like wading pools and green stormwater infrastructure, a small but important remodel of a community center at Magnuson Park and the appropriate staff necessary to make that facility work well. But I think the biggest and boldest thing that I'm proud that we led on this year was around the creation of a safe consumption site. And that $1.3 million, that's deserved. That $1.3 million is without a doubt going to be controversial. We're seeing cities all throughout the region take up resolutions in opposition to these kinds of concepts. And I want to highlight one of the reasons why I've been such a champion. I got an email earlier in the week from a constituent named Rose, and I asked her for her permission to read parts of this email. And if you'll permit my indulgence, Council President, I want to read to you all why she believes it's so important that we set up safe consumption sites in the city. Rose is a first-year medical student at the University of Washington and says, all of the available public health and medical data says that safe consumption spaces reduce public drug use, reduce drug paraphernalia in public spaces, and do not increase drug use in the surrounding communities. Having a space to go and interact with non-judgmental healthcare workers and access services has been shown to improve rates of seeking and completing detoxification programs by as much as 30%. Rose's brother is in recovery and clean from drug use disorder for 4 years. He and his partner, also clean and in recovery, are expecting their family's first grandchild in this Christmas. And Rose says, even when he was using drugs and his brain chemistry and body wouldn't let him walk away from using, he was still my brother, and I still loved him very much. People suffering from drug use disorders are valued and loved by their families and friends, and they matter to society as a whole. And I'm going to follow the trend of you, Council President Harrell. That is an important F line that I feel compelled to repeat it twice. People suffering from drug use disorders are valued and loved by their families and friends, and they matter to society as a whole. The country is watching Seattle as we endeavor to join the rest of the developed world in responding to drug use disorders with empathy and scientifically sound, evidence-based approaches. Properly funding safe consumption sites is critical to establishing their credibility and proving Seattle as a city ready to take on the challenges of the future. I'm really proud of the work I did with you, my friends out in communities, particularly Patricia, Allison, and Lisa, and really grateful to my colleagues for support for such an important step in preventing future lives from being lost in our city.
Well said.
That was Seattle City Councilmember Rob Johnson speaking at their meeting November 20th, at which the city's budget was adopted, a budget which included funding to start up a supervised consumption facility. You can hear that meeting and much more at seattlechannel.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. From Seattle, we go to London, England. The UK House of Commons held a debate on November 20th on the human and financial costs of drug addiction. We're going to listen to a portion of that debate. Here's Norman Lamb, a Liberal Democrat and Member of Parliament for North Norfolk.
Let me start with where I agree with the Honourable Member, and I congratulate him for getting a debate on a really important issue. As a father myself, I share the horror of the impact of dangerous drug use. And my starting point, in a sense, is to be hostile to dangerous drug use, whether they are legal or illegal. And that's a really important point because, according to the evidence, the most dangerous drug of all is alcohol, one that is used very heavily within these buildings. Mm-hmm. We must remember that. and there is an enormous hypocrisy, therefore, about the debate on this issue. For me, the most depressing thing that was said in the chamber of the House of Commons today was the Prime Minister's reaffirmation of the commitment to the war on drugs, the catastrophically disastrous war on drugs. And it was in response to the Right Honourable Member's question, the Honourable Member for Reigate, who raised a totally rational case and got it rejected with what I would say was a rejection of the evidence, an approach based on stigma and based on an ignorance of the facts of the disastrous impact on the war of the war on drugs. It was an enormous pleasure just the other day to meet with some parents, together with the Honourable Member for Inverclyde, from the organisation Anyone's Child. And far from what the Prime Minister said about the victims, the families of those who've lost lives through drug use, all rallying round to demand ever tougher sentences, these brave people are making the case very powerfully that the disastrous consequences for their families of the criminalisation of drug use has left them distraught for the rest of their lives. And in a way, the great irony I find in the Honourable Gentleman's contribution today is that he pointed out to a whole series of disastrous consequences of drug use under a criminal market. Mm. I mean, this is the extraordinary thing that he's... I'm completely with him about identifying and recognising these disasters, but it's happening here and now. It's this false thinking that suggests that because there are dangers of drug use, the automatically sensible thing to do is to ban them. But we should know by now that that doesn't work. Mm. And the Home Office's own study in 2014 confirmed that it has no impact on the level of drug use in society. So let's start thinking afresh about this issue. Far from protecting people... I'm just conscious time is really tight. Far from protecting people, the current framework of our drug laws has resulted in 3,744 drug-related deaths in 2016, the highest ever level. A 44% increase over 5 years. It's not just the states we're talking about here. It's arrived in this country with a vengeance. Heroin and morphine deaths risen by 109% under a criminal market. It is not working. Criminalisation. He said he doesn't see many people ending up in prison. But just last year, there were still 45,000 people ending up with criminal convictions for possession of drugs. Now, this has a dreadful blighting effect on their careers. We waste human capital in our country. One of the families that came to talk to us on Monday talked about their son, a really clever scientist, who now can't work as a scientist because of the effect of his conviction several years ago now. This is just ludicrous, but it's the effect of criminalisation. And the Australian study from a few years ago confirms the negative impact of criminalisation on all of those people who end up with a criminal record. And it hits many people who self-medicate because they are experiencing mental ill health. So it has a massive impact on people who are already vulnerable because they choose to use a substance to perhaps take away the pain of what they're going through. We then give them a criminal conviction. It's the most ludicrous response imaginable. And then there are all those people who suffer from conditions like multiple sclerosis, who use cannabis to ease the pain, and then we give them a criminal conviction for their trouble. Again, it's a ludicrous way of responding to a real problem. And the billions of pounds in profits to organised crime. We just hand vast sums of money, not just in this country, but globally, to organised crime, and it's the most extraordinary waste of resources. It promotes extreme violence in our communities, and of course it's always the poorest communities that suffer the most. And in the United States, there's very clear evidence that it's poor black communities that suffer the most. In this country, Black people are targeted for stop and search. They're 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched for drug use than white people are in our country. So instead of these awful consequences of criminalising drug use, let's think about an alternative approach which may be more rational, which may be based on evidence, not based on ignorance and stigma. Let's instead regulate the market for cannabis. The evidence that the Honourable Gentleman raised from the states in the US which have legalised are highly contested data. And there are very respected organisations, and I hopefully can refer to the Drug Policy Alliance, which address some of the misclaims about the impacts of cannabis use in Colorado and Washington. One of the conclusions, teen marijuana use is unchanged. The overall conclusions, so far so good in terms of the impact of legalization. So there's a lot of misclaims being made about the impact in the United States. But a legalized, regulated market has the potential to take the trade away from criminals and instead to raise pounds in taxes, which can then be used on health and education and supporting people out of addiction rather than simply criminalizing them. Let's treat it as a health issue, not a criminal justice issue. Let's accept across our country the principle of safer drug consumption rooms. They are already saving lives in 8 European countries, in Canada, in Australia. It's endorsed by the BMA. No one dies of an overdose in a drug consumption room. Let's accept that evidence and apply it in this country before we continue the carnage of loss of life that we're experiencing now. And heroin-assisted treatment, where other treatments have failed, I recognise that the Honourable Member acknowledged that that may be appropriate in some cases, but it's a policy that is based on evidence of what works. And then finally, Mr. Gapes, the attitude of this government. I've mentioned the 2014 Home Office study. This was whilst the Prime Minister was Home Secretary, and her own department concluded that there's no international evidence at all which shows that tougher drug laws reduce the use of drugs in society. So why don't they follow the evidence? Secondly, the evaluation of the government's drug strategy last year, their own evaluation, raised some extremely serious concerns. It's concluded that enforcement expenditure has, and I quote, little impact on availability. And I quote again, illicit drug markets are resilient and can adapt to even significant drug and asset seizures. It doesn't work. Contact with the criminal justice system for drug offences can, and I quote, bring with it potential unintended consequences, including unemployment and harm to families. And then finally, incarceration may also negatively impact on the indirect and unemployment harms that drug-related enforcement activities seek to improve. The conclusion of the government's own analysis is that it's not working. And then there's the real hypocrisy, that there will be loads of ministers in this government who have used cannabis and probably other drugs as well in their younger years, and yet they are prepared to see fellow citizens convicted of offences which for something that they did in their younger years themselves, and they've gone on to enjoy good careers. Let's stop the hypocrisy. Let's recognise that we should be applying the approach of reduction in harm, not criminalisation, because it hasn't worked and it's led to awful consequences internationally.
That was Norman Lamb, Member of Parliament in the United Kingdom, speaking in a House of Commons debate on the human and financial costs of drug addiction. You're listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Now let's return to that parliamentary debate and hear from Crispin Blunt, a Conservative and Member of Parliament for Reigate.
And a pleasure to follow my Honourable Gentleman for Norfolk. And I want to congratulate him on his speech, and I agree with his analysis entirely. And I do want to congratulate though, my Honourable Friend for Thanet Saiv for raising this issue. And he's quite right to point out the dramatic risk there is of fentanyl associated harm that is maybe coming our way following what is happening in the United States. But any examination of the global evidence is that the costs he pointed to, financial and human, are infinitely higher than they should be due to the global policy of prohibition and criminalization of drugs ever since the 1961 UN Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. It has been an unmitigated global public policy disaster. He rightly drew attention to the dangers of drug driving and his concern that the increasing number of road deaths caused by drug driving that's coming in the United States. And this is going to require strong enforcement action to catch, warn and punish offenders in the same way that drink driving here in the UK has met with effective policing and societal attitude changes. I'm so short of time because of if the Honourable General will forgive me. I come to this debate from the criminal justice perspective, having seen for myself as Minister for Prisons and Criminal Justice the time and costs incurred by the police, courts, prison and probation service in managing the effect of drug-related crime. My Honourable friend also drew attention to the problems of cannabis, and particularly street cannabis, with which high levels of tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, is more potent and liable to cause schizophrenia in long-term users. However, those looking to use cannabis recreationally often have little to choose from and have no idea where their cannabis is acquired on the street from drug dealers or what it's got in it. So legislation and regulation would allow consumers to access less harmful forms of cannabis with lower levels of THC and higher levels of CBD, cannabidiol, giving the desired high. In just the same way that drug users of tobacco and alcohol can be assured of the regulated quality and provenance of their products, together with the health warnings and all the necessary restrictions on advertising and sales and regulation that a proper regulated market can deliver. Licensing and regulation, proportionate to the risks of each type of drug and signposting users to services when they get into trouble, would be the right place for public policy if we followed the evidence of what works. At a stroke, it would deliver the massive good of eliminating the huge costs associated with criminal possession and supply. By permitting a legal but regulated market, we would decouple millions, hundreds of millions of consumers in the world and millions in the UK alone from funding and facilitating a world of criminality. Just as prohibition in 1920s America provided a financial basis for organised crime to flourish in American cities, so our policy of prohibition has gifted an industry worth the order of $500 billion a year to serious and organised crime, producing and supplying untested substances. Their interest is hardly the health of their consumers, but far more to produce the addiction that will sustain this vastly lucrative business model. Alongside the addiction, we then have to deal with the awful consequences of drug market violence as gangs and dealers vie for control of the trade, quite apart from the enormous lower-level criminality of burglary and other acquisitive crimes as addicts seek to fund their addiction. As well as keeping criminals, many of them young people, out of drug supply, licensing and regulation allows us to tackle the health-related harms associated with drugs and drug addiction that my honourable friend was so right to draw attention to. Criminalisation means that users are hidden from health practitioners and there's a lack of guidance about how to find and access services. Taxation of sales by licensed retailers would pay for better prevention, treatment and public health available at the point of purchase, and particularly public health education. For instance, from a dispensing pharmacist. Colorado has now already raised $500 billion in state taxes and fees since it licensed recreational cannabis in 2014. And as the Honourable Gentleman just said, the Home Office evaluation of its own drug strategy says there is, in general, a lack of robust evidence as to whether capture and punishment serves as a deterrent for drug use. Translated out of bureaucracies, that means we know current policy doesn't work. And since we've been fighting the war on drugs for over half a century, it might now be an idea to examine the evidence. So I say to my honourable friend, instead of doubling down on a failing policy and demanding yet more higher sentences for particular parts of this supply chain, the failing policy, which, in the example he gave, has led to the highest level of opioid drug deaths since records began, we should be learning from decriminalisation and public health approaches in other countries. In Portugal, for example, where the possession of small amounts of drugs has been decriminalised since 2001, a step well short of licensing and regulation, usage rates are amongst the lowest in Europe, and drug-related pathologies such as blood-borne viruses and deaths due to misuse have decreased dramatically. Compare the drug mortality of 5.8 per million in Portugal to Scotland. It's 247 per million in Scotland. The Portuguese state offers treatment programs without dragging users through the criminal justice system, where it becomes harder to manage addiction and abuse. And I can tell my honourable friend from the effort to establish drug-free wings in prisons, this is not easy to do. I accept it to a perfectly sound policy objective, but do not think for a minute there is a magic wand to be able to deliver some part of the prison system that is going to be proof against drugs getting into it. And in the criminal justice system, as I can testify from my own experience, it is hard to manage addiction and abuse. And the reshaping of our drugs policies should be informed by the growing body of evidence that is going to come in from the legalisation of cannabis sales in several US states and from next July in Canada. And we'll be able to learn, too, from the Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany and others who have drug consumption rooms. An example of the kind of regulation we could deliver around heroin consumption in supervised, safer environments, where, as the Honourable Gentleman says, no one has ever died of an overdose. And so we must listen to the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which seeks a balanced and evidence-based approach. In the UK, our commission could be a royal commission to make evidence-based policy recommendations free of the politician's trite response, drugs are bad, they must be banned. This can give us a route to reframing the debate on drugs and find evidence-based policy approaches which truly reduce the costs of addiction, both financial and human.
That was Crispin Blunt, a Conservative Member of Parliament, speaking in a House of Commons debate on the human and financial costs of drug addiction on November 20th. You can hear that debate in full by going to parliamentlive.tv.
So marijuana is legal in Nevada now, right? And I heard a story about this guy who won a lot of money, won like $100,000. The stoner came up to him and said, "Hey man, I know you won $100,000. I normally wouldn't ask this, but my girlfriend is very sick. I need $10,000 so she can have an operation." And the gambler says, "Well, how do I know if I give you this $10,000, you're not just gonna go buy some marijuana?" And the stoner goes, "Man, I have weed money."
And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Drug Truth Network programs are available via podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network is on Facebook. Please give its page a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course, also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.